everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're very happy to have Brett Whalen on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, Dominion of God, Christendom and Apocalypse in the Middle Ages. You may know that in the Gospels, Jesus told the disciples that just before the end time, the good news would be preached throughout the world. Well, the clerics of the Middle Ages, of course, knew this too, and they also knew that the good news was not being preached all over the world. In fact, it wasn't even being preached in Jerusalem, which was held, of course, by infidels. Well, they thought something had to be done about this, and thereupon followed the Crusades. Thus was the Church of Christ turned into the Army of God. This is the story that Brett tells, and tells very well in this book. As he points out, during the Crusades, things got a little bit out of hand, and what followed was a conflict between various factions within the church itself. This is a terrific book, and it has lessons for our time, I think. I really enjoyed talking to Brett today, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Brett.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm very well. It's sunny and very nice here in Iowa today. You know, falls are beautiful here. You're in North Carolina, is that right?
Yeah, and here it is gray and a little rainy, although we've had a bit of a drought lately, so
I'm sorry to hear that.
I'm not complaining.
Yeah, the people. For some reason, there are a lot of people in our department who got their PhDs at UNC, and they say very nice things about it. Let's put it that way. Not to disparage Iowa, I love Iowa, but they say very nice things about North Carolina. I should tell our listeners that we're talking to Brett Whalen today, and we'll be discussing his terrific new book, Dominion of God, Christendom, and Apocalypse in the Middle Ages. I'm sorry I cut you off, Brett. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say I've been here in North Carolina since 2005, and I've been enjoying it a great deal myself.
Yeah, and where are you from originally?
I grew up in Montpelier, Vermont, so I am a Yankee living down here in the southern land.
Yeah, well, why don't you just go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Well, I was born in 1972 in Montpelier, Vermont, and I wound up attending the University of Vermont later. I guess I skipped over a lot of my life there. Thinking back before the university, I was lucky that I grew up near the public library and spent a lot of time perusing books over there, including The Hobbit, which if I had to pick a book that was formative for my intellectual development, that might be one of the most important ones.
Mm-hmm.
And then moving on to Lord of the Rings and things like this. And I was also an avid role player.
Oh, really?
Yes, I was. I know nowadays where you have a lot of the stuff is online, but this is still back in the day when you had the paper and the dice.
Oh, I remember. Did you play it? Now, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you've caught my imagination. Did you play Dungeons & Dragons and that sort of thing?
I did play Dungeons &
Dragons.
Yeah,
well, you see,
among other games.
I don't know if a book has been written about the impact of Dungeons & Dragons on American culture, but there should be one, because I've literally found it everywhere. I played, and I found it everywhere, literally everywhere. People, especially who do a little bit geeky things as adults, like computer programmers, I think all played it. It's astounding if you talk to people of a certain age who kind of led the computer programming revolution. They all played Dungeons and Dragons, and they sort of transferred the first role playing games into massive multiplayer games in the 1970s and 80s. So
certainly amongst medievalists, I think you find it's not uncommon to run into people who spent time playing D&D and reading Tolkien when they were growing up.
Oh, yeah. No, it's extraordinarily common. Yeah, no, I knew. This was in Kansas. I knew about it. I mean, it took off very quickly. Anyway, this is enough about D&D.
Sure. Well, then, it's sometimes childhood things like that can be a really important part of fostering an interest, certainly.
Yeah.
Then I was fortunate when I went off to the university that there's a top-rate medievalist there, Alfred J. Andrea. And one of the first classes I ever took with him was not a medieval history class, but was actually a pre-modern global history class. And this is one of these courses that you start out in Mesopotamia and make your way all the way up to basically Christopher Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
And a great deal of the focus in that class, the way he taught it anyway, was on the development of different religious traditions.
Mm-hmm.
Starting out, including Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, and looking at the role of religion in the development of global civilizations, and importantly, the spread of religions and the way that impacts the broader historical development of cultures and civilizations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He also, though, was a medievalist. And with this childhood interest of mine in the Middle Ages, I wound up gravitating towards his classes and taking a number of classes on medieval Europe with Professor Andrea.
Mm-hmm.
And I, in many ways, he was a role model. Where I remember at one point listening to him lecture, and I just thought, I want that guy's job.
Yeah,
this seems great.
I'm sorry, it's funny you say that. I've said this before on the show, but I had a very similar experience when I went to college, actually here in Iowa at Grinnell College, and I actually went to play basketball, and I met a guy who has become my mentor, and he's a medievalist. He does medieval Russia, and I sat in his classes, and I had the same reaction. I thought, this guy is really smart, and I want his job, and so I basically tried to get it.
Yeah, man, I think this can be a common experience where you see a teacher like that,
yeah.
And it makes such a big impact.
Yeah,
on,
no, it's absolutely true. And so then you went off to graduate school.
Well, I did, and then it was actually, I have to say, it was a little bit more of a long and winding path than that, because I was not necessarily the most focused undergraduate student. Let's just put it that way. I did find in my history classes, I sometimes was a little uneven, and also I hadn't done any Latin.
Yeah.
And so around senior year, I thought to myself, you know, I'd like to become a history professor, and ran into the somewhat uncomfortable fact that to do research at that level, of course, you need to be able to read the sources in their original language.
Right.
And I applied to a number of graduate programs and actually didn't get in anywhere. And I realize now I was applying to these PhD programs, and I was nowhere near prepared to go on to that level. And so what I wound up doing was actually going out to the West Coast and then taking an intensive Latin class. And that was my sort of conversion. If you're thinking of Augustine and conversion and things like this, right, that was my conversion experience, where I became much more of a focused student and worked a lot harder than I ever had, because I had a goal at that point. And the Latin was then what enabled me to enter into a master's program, and I actually went back to the University of Vermont, because they had a terminal master's program, so there's no PhD students, but just MA students. And I worked with Al Andrea Moore there, and from that point then wound up applying to Stanford and going to the PhD program. And I think none the worse for the wear. Maybe I'd say even a lot better off, that having, at least for, in my case, taking that slow boat, working on my language skills, sort of maturing intellectually, worked out well, that I felt much more prepared to jump into grad school and work my way forward from there. I should add also that a lot of my intellectual interests, though, in school did start back at the University of Vermont.
Well, why don't you tell us how you came to write Dominion of God?
Well, one of the interests that I developed when I was doing my master's degree was an interest in the split between the Latin and Greek churches in the High Middle Ages, so starting in the 11th, 12th, 13th centuries. This is something that a lot of people are familiar with, this idea of the schism between the Catholic and Orthodox churches. Many people, this comes up in Western Civ classes, for example, with the date 1054, oftentimes featuring quite prominently, where you have this split between the two churches over a number of differences of doctrine and their liturgical practices. And this was something that interested me, not as a point of ecclesiastical history, but rather, I wound up wondering, how did Latin Christians, Western Christians, the followers of Rome, how did they see their difference from the Greek Orthodox Church? How did they see themselves as being distinctly Latin Christians?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a question that more and more started to interest me, was this issue of Latin identity, Western Christian identity.
Mm-hmm. And how did you, how did you move from that moment into this... Because the book is really about sort of millenarianism and the sort of attempt, what I think of as the attempt to force the end time, but maybe I'm wrong about that. But how did you segue into that?
Well, that's a great question. It's part of what I encountered as I was working on this topic of the division between the two churches was the idea that at the end of time, the difference between them would somehow be reconciled, that the Greeks would in fact convert, so to speak, or return to the obedience of the Roman Church. One of the big sort of cornerstone moments of this project is when I was at Stanford, I was working on a project on, I was actually about Christian views of Islam, and I wound up finding the works of the apocalyptic thinker Joachim of Fiore,
mm-hmm.
who's a 12th century southern Italian abbot, and one of the more well-known apocalyptic thinkers of the Middle Ages. And I started reading his texts, and I realized that he, in fact, spoke a lot more about the division between the Latin and Greek churches
mm-hmm.
than he did about relations between Christians and Muslims. And this sort of brought me back to this question of the Latin and Greek churches and their estrangement, but also, according to Joachim, he developed this idea, and as far as I know, he's the first apocalyptic thinker to bring this into the field of view, that the two churches would be reunited at the end of time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then this factored in, additionally, to this idea, which goes back to the Christian New Testament, that at the end of time, a portion of the Jews will convert to Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And for Joachim, you have this staged process whereby the Greeks will return to the Latin church, the Jews will convert. Around the same time, you'll see the spread of the gospel to pagan peoples. And so there will then be, and Joachim uses this biblical quotation that comes up quite a bit in my work, John 10:16, there will be one fold and one shepherd. There will be one flock and one sheepfold, mm-hmm. one and one shepherd.
Yeah, I was going to actually ask you about the biblical provenance of these prophecies, and the one that... The one that called to my mind was where, and I don't remember exactly where it happens, where Jesus tells the disciples that things are going to get really bad.
Yeah.
And then they're going to get a lot better. Yeah, they're going to get bad, and then the churches are going to unite, or the gospel is going to be preached everywhere, and then the end of days will come. I mean, are there other places in the Old Testament and New Testament where this is hinted at? Is it in Daniel?
Well, Daniel's an important book for this. I mean, first of all, you're exactly right that that's from Matthew 24.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a similar episode comes up in Mark also. And I think Luke also. It's sometimes called the Little Apocalypse,
mm-hmm.
where Christ predicts there will be war and there'll be rumors of war. There will be people are going to persecute you for your beliefs. There'll be a time of tribulation.
False prophets. Don't forget false prophets.
There will be false prophets. This is going to be a rough time, right?
Yeah, right.
But one of the things he says is that my message, before the end, my message will reach all the peoples of
mm-hmm.
the world.
Yeah.
And this is something that later Christian thinkers picked up on.
Well, I guess one question that immediately occurs to me, and I bet it occurs to the people who listen to this, is how, after 1,000 years of this, did Christian thinkers suddenly think we ought to be, as we would say today, proactive about this, that this is not a prediction so much as it is an action plan, and we should go and start converting people or take over the Holy Land?
Yeah, I mean, that's where I think, while Christian apocalyptic thought is something that you can track and trace for from the first century up until the 21st century, part of what I'm doing in the book is looking at a particular, I mean, I could say a historical moment. It's actually like 3 centuries long, so
quite
a long moment, from the 11th to the 14th centuries. And this is a period that is associated with the emergence of a particularly strong and assertive Roman papacy.
Mm-hmm.
Beginning in the 11th century, a period that's sometimes referred to as that of the papal reform movement, or sometimes called the Gregorian reform after Pope
mm-hmm.
Gregory VII.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a period where the papacy starts to really step forward and agitate more for its own authority as the head of the Christian church in Western Europe, but theoretically as the leader of Christians everywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most well-known outgrowths of this, in part, I mean, there's a lot of factors that go into it, but in part is the First Crusade.
Mm-hmm. And so why don't you tell us about the genesis of that?
Yeah, where you have Urban II and at the Council of Clermont in November of 1095, standing up, and as in his capacity as Pope, calling upon Christians to stop fighting each other, and to set forth and rather turn their swords against these unbelievers who have possessed the holy places of Jerusalem.
Uh-huh.
Now, this vision of papal leadership that you see with Pope Urban is certainly a product of, and also a particularly strong example of, this new vision of papal leadership over
mm-hmm.
Christian society.
And
it really gets started more around the 1050s under Leo IX, and then starts to pick up speed over the second half of the 11th century.
And what was the old version of the sort of organizational chart, the org chart of Christendom? I know it's very different in the East, which I've studied a little bit, but I mean, I guess my question is, how did it come to happen that the papacy needed to assert its authority? Because we think of the papacy as the authority of the Catholic Church.
Sure, sure. And this is something, I think there's a vision of the papacy that's very much with us today of an institution that exercises this sort of leadership over the church.
Yeah, exactly.
The bottom line is, though, if you look back, I mean, the papacy is not always, but at least since around the 3rd or 4th century, has claimed special privileges and prerogatives and authority, based in particular on the fact that St. Peter himself, according to Catholic tradition, founded the Bishopric of Rome.
Yeah.
And this brings you to Matthew 16:18, where it can be interpreted anyway that Christ delegates authority to Peter to manage the church, basically, after Christ is gone.
Yeah.
Peter founds Rome, so the bishops of Rome are Peter's heirs and can draw upon that authority, but leads them back ultimately to Peter and through Peter to Christ.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But for much of the early Middle Ages, the popes never really have the wherewithal or the opportunity or the infrastructural sort of backing to really try to exercise that authority in any meaningful way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But suddenly they get it in the 10th, 11th century?
There's a lot of changes that start happening in the 11th century, and this is a period where, speaking in general terms, this is a period where if you think of the earlier Middle Ages as an era of there's a shrinking economy, cities are smaller, trade is at a minimal. This is a period, we want to avoid the term Dark Ages, right?
Okay.
but if you still had to use the label somewhere, I think you could look back and maybe and see the early Middle Ages in the period immediately after the transformation, the sort of collapse of the Roman Imperial Order.
Uh-huh.
That was a time Europe is definitely not particularly dynamic. That starts to change in the 10th and particularly in the 11th century. And this is a period where commerce starts to revive, cities are being built, growing. The political scene starts changing too. This is the beginning of starting to see particularly stronger monarchs and kings. And you see the papacy in some sense as a participant in these broader changes.
Mm-hmm,
and starting to develop a much more dynamic sort of ideology, but also starting to have the resources in addition to put on the ground, to be sending out legates, to be trying to exercise more direct authority over churches across Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this leads to a lot of conflict, too, within Europe. And that's one thing that's sort of hovering in the background of my book, is this idea, one reason the popes are so eager to put forth this vision of their authority over the world and projecting it into the future, into the apocalyptic future, is a lot of times they're having trouble convincing people right in their backyard of their own authority,
mm-hmm.
particularly emperors, the German emperor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and some of your listeners will no doubt be familiar with the investiture controversy, for
yes,
example,
right.
which
uh-huh.
is this conflict between popes and emperors in the later 11th century
mm-hmm.
about who has the right to basically appoint or consecrate bishops.
Yeah, I must admit that, much to my shame, I think I studied with what was his name? Bisson. What was it? What's his first name?
Oh, Thomas Bisson.
Yeah, I think I studied with Thomas Bisson when I was in graduate school, and he will be ashamed of me now, I'm sure. But wasn't that the era in which all the German emperors were named Otto? There was like Otto 1 through 10 or something?
The Octonians are a little bit earlier,
okay.
Very late 10th, early 11th.
Okay, all right. Yeah, well.
And that's actually a period where, if you're thinking back sort of before my book starts, I actually start the book around the year 1000.
Okay.
And that's a period under the Ottonians where the papacy is, relatively speaking, a weak institution.
Mm-hmm, I see.
And the Ottonian emperors, the German emperors, actually exercise a great deal of authority over the papacy at that
mm-hmm,
time.
Mm-hmm, I see. So let me ask you this, because it, although indulges a certain presentism, because it brings to mind another crusading concept, I always wondered about this. What is the scriptural authority? On what basis did the popes argue that the Christians should pick up the sword and forcibly retake the Holy Land or convert Jews or convert, that's not quite the right word, the Orthodox Christians? How did they base this? Did they try to base this in Scripture, or how did they argue for it?
Well, certainly, there's a very ambivalent attitude towards towards armed violence in the Christian tradition. Christ says, turn the other cheek. Christ also drives the moneylenders from the temple, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so an episode like in the Gospel where Christ is driving the moneylenders from the temple can be seen as a moment where, at points, in order to defend the faith or somehow maintain the integrity or protect the Christian community, you can think about this idea that it might be appropriate at points to take up arms or to actually use force in defense of the faith.
Mm-hmm.
Another interesting notion here is this idea where we're in the Gospel, where there's this idea of people taking up their cross and basically following Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a biblical reference that comes up a great deal in reference to the Crusaders actually sewing crosses or painting crosses or
mm-hmm.
somehow representing crosses on their clothes.
Mm-hmm.
That they are actually imitating Christ. They are literally taking up the cross.
Mm-hmm.
There's a fascinating article, it came out in the late 70s, I believe, by Jonathan Riley Smith, who's a very prominent historian of the Crusades, which is called Crusading as an Act of Love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I
deliberately titled it in a somewhat provocative manner.
Yeah, no, I can certainly understand that. I guess one thing that I'm interested in as well is this notion, because it also relates to another modern form of, I guess, millenarianism, this one Jewish. Is there any scriptural basis for thinking that Christians have to be in control of Jerusalem? I mean, is that mentioned as one of the sort of triggers for the end time, or is there any reason why Christians have to have the Holy Land in order for the end time to come?
If you're thinking it on a scriptural basis, my first instinct would be to say no. I mean, how does the Christian Bible end? It ends with the book of Revelation,
mm-hmm.
and it ends with Jerusalem featuring quite prominently. But, of course, it's the heavenly Jerusalem.
Yeah, right.
That's descending, right? It's God's kingdom.
Right, the new Jerusalem.
It's the new Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And certainly you find some Christian thinkers going back as far as the 4th century when pilgrimage to Jerusalem is actually starting, and there seems to be an increasing interest among Christians. This is after Constantine converts and the Roman Empire starts to become Christian.
Mm-hmm.
You see more and more interest in pilgrimage. There's church building in Jerusalem. Some people are very uncomfortable with this idea.
Yeah.
That you shouldn't be focused on the earthly Jerusalem. But I think still, it's such a powerful notion to somehow have possession or be in the place where Christ lived, carried out his ministry, died, was resurrected, and ascended to heaven. So even if there isn't necessarily a firm scriptural imperative to have control or possession of Jerusalem, I think it's an idea that some Christians, anyway, just found so compelling and frankly had trouble letting go of or looking beyond.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And I know that in the case of, well, in the case of a lot of movements such as this, let's put it this way, millenarian movements, that they there is something extra scriptural that they're calling on that is pushing them or convincing them to do something, because it is relatively difficult, I think, to find the notion of a crusade in any of the books of the New Testament or excuse any such thing, but they managed to do it. So let's go back to the role of the papacy for just a second. So are you saying then that, to put it most provocatively, that the Crusades are sort of a papal power play?
Well, I would say that the Crusades emerge in part out of this expression of Christian of papal leadership. I think it's hard to imagine the Crusades without thinking about the 11th century Reform era papacy as really looking to put forth its authority to speak for the Christian community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so. I mean, issues of the sort of power dynamics within Europe between popes and emperors and kings, I think, are clearly at play. Of course, then there's this whole other question that I don't really get into in my book of how the laity received this message and might have adopted it and adapted it and thought about it in their own terms. I mean, I don't think we can imagine the pope as a sort of puppet master, you know, marionette pulling the strings. I don't think that does any justice to the reality
mm-hmm.
and limits of papal power in the 11th and 12th centuries. I think also, of course, you know, once the message is, as we know from our own days, right, once the message is put out there, people can oftentimes read it and interpret it in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a whole other current of enthusiasm for crusading that had really very little to do with the papacy.
So they launched the first crusade, and it goes pretty well, if I recall
correctly.
Yeah, I mean,
they captured Jerusalem.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I think that when you read the histories of the crusade, the chronicles, they're written after the capture of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Everyone knows how the crusade turns out.
Yeah, right.
And so they look back and then have to explain this dramatic event. I mean, this is in itself almost of biblical proportion.
Right.
And the conquest of Jerusalem really has a lot of different sort of resonances, one of them being when the Romans sacked the city in 70 CE, there's a Jewish rebellion, the city is sacked.
Yeah.
According to Christians, that was a moment where God had basically punished the Jews for rejecting Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Christians have control of Jerusalem under Constantine in the 4th century. But then the Muslims come and take it away from their perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jerusalem has been lost.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it's been regained again.
Yeah.
And so there's this sort of meta-narrative, you can imagine, going from the Bible all the way up to 1099 when the Crusaders capture the city. And they're suddenly thinking to themselves, how do we explain this? This is one of the biggest, as Robert the Monk says in his Crusade Chronicle, this is the biggest thing that's happened since Christ was here. He says that straight up.
I'm reminded of John Lennon saying he's bigger than Christ. But I see that. So were people thinking, well, this is the sign, and now Christ is going to descend, and we're all going to be raptured?
There's a debate among scholars about just how much apocalyptic thought was a factor in spurring on enthusiasm for the Crusades,
mm-hmm.
and just how much it might have shaped reactions to the Crusade, the First Crusade, immediately. I mean, one interesting thing, you were asking earlier about justifications for the capture of Jerusalem. Another Crusade chronicler, Guibert of Nogent, writes that everyone knows the Antichrist is going to come.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know that he will come in Jerusalem. And we all know that he'll persecute Christians. So we need to have some Christians in Jerusalem. and he actually attributes these words to Pope Urban II. I highly doubt Urban ever said this.
Yeah.
So basically saying we need to capture the city so there'll be Christians there for Antichrist to persecute.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Well, I just want
to jump in and say the rapture, just for the record, is more of a Protestant 19th
century. Sorry about that. Yes, I should correct. Yeah, I was raised a Lutheran, so I'm always waiting to be raptured. I hope it's not while I'm in line for coffee, because I'll need coffee on the way. But you've kind of reminded me of the search for the unblemished red calf, which many of, I think there are Midwesterners who've gotten together with Orthodox Jews to look for, because in order for something that I can't remember exactly what it is, you need an unblemished red calf, and so they're
to help trigger the end time scenario.
I guess it is. Yeah, I can never really remember, but there's this peculiar alliance of fundamentalist Christians and Orthodox Jews.
Oh, certainly.
I was looking for this red calf.
That's interesting, and you know, the whole time I was writing this book, I'd be lying if I said a lot of this present day stuff. I mean, it is sort of. Was in the back of my mind, and control of Jerusalem, and you do have evangelical Christian groups who have links with sort of more right wing Jewish groups. It's fascinating how much this whole question of who possesses Jerusalem—it's
right.
still such a third rail, such a lightning rod.
Well, yeah, I mean,
Jews, Christians, Muslims.
I mean, I think you bring up an extraordinarily good point, and because it's not exactly the same context, but it's pretty darn close.
And this is something I bring up at the very conclusion of my book. I mean, while I was writing this book, it seemed like not a day would go. I remember driving home from work one day and listening to NPR, and Terry Gross was interviewing John Hagee, who's one of these. He has a group called Christians United for Israel in Texas, and part of why they support the state of Israel. It's part of their end time scenario.
Right, exactly. They're probably looking for the red calf too.
They might be actually.
Red calf.
So it was interesting to be working on this stuff in the 12th and 13th century. And of course, things look very different back then than they do now.
Uh-huh.
And as a historian, I want to be attentive to these crucial differences. But at the same time, there's an interesting story here that I think we're all still kind of participating in.
No, that's an absolutely
fascinating sort of. I was going to say trans-historical, but trans-temporal. It's really lasted such a long time, this issue, and it doesn't seem to want to go away. I'm a bit fatigued of it. I was thinking that, you know, there really hasn't been a moment in my somewhat lengthy life now in which I have not been able to wake up and find some article in the paper of record about Jerusalem. It's just, you can't get away from it. It's just everywhere. So let me go back to the Crusades again. So the first one went well, but again, as somebody that studied Byzantium and Russia for many years, the second one did not go so well.
No,
it pretty well went pear shaped. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean they wound up attacking Damascus, which was actually a Muslim, the capital of the Muslim kingdom was allied with the Crusaders at that point.
Yeah.
The bottom, one thing I find interesting in terms of thinking, Christians thinking about God's plan for history, is the fact that the Second Crusade does not go particularly well. And then, of course, in 1187, Salah al-Din winds up recapturing Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And so Jerusalem is lost again. The Fourth Crusade, I'm sure as somebody who's studied Byzantine Russian history, I don't have to tell you.
Yeah.
1204 captures Constantinople, a Greek city, and we could probably talk about that
for
an interview in and of itself. But this raises a problem, doesn't it? When the Crusaders capture Jerusalem, people writing about the Crusade can say, we have achieved this miraculous thing. When you lose Jerusalem, when the Crusade doesn't go so well, you have a problem, don't you? You need to explain why. What have we done that God so ticked off at us, basically?
Yeah. Well, what did they say?
Well, a lot of times it had to do with sin.
Yeah.
And this goes back again to the Christian Old Testament, this idea that when the Hebrews fail to observe God's law, he punishes them, he scourges them, not to destroy them, but to correct them.
Uh-huh.
And you see this idea develop in Crusader ideology that we clearly are not worthy, we have sinned, and this notion that when things go bad in history, it's on account of sin, and this then leads to calls for further reform. We need to clean up our act.
Right.
If we can only do that, then perhaps, again, we'll be worthy of regaining Jerusalem.
Yeah, this is an arrow that has been in the quiver of clerical reformers for a long, long time. Then, so let's go back then before we move on to this reformist tendency that comes out of the difficulties that they have in the Holy Land. Let's talk a little bit about the taking of Constantinople, which I think many people don't really understand because, you know, as you say, it is a Greek city. What were they doing there?
This is one of the Fourth Crusade. Definitely gets a lot of bad press, which raises the interesting idea that maybe all the other crusades are okay. and it's fine to be fighting Muslims, but well, you're fighting fellow Christians.
Yeah.
I mean, I think on a moral level, there's problems with crusading in general. But regardless, there is this idea that somehow the Fourth Crusade, there's books written about it called The Great Betrayal, The Unholy Crusade.
Yeah.
And part of what I try to explore in my book is this idea of how even the capture of Constantinople could have a certain logic to it. And there's a whole debate about how they wind up there. Basically, they wind up going to Constantinople to help install this young exiled prince on the throne, and he promises them funds. He promises to help support the crusade in return, to make a long story short.
Mm-hmm.
And he then doesn't have the funds or refuses to hand over the money, and the situation deteriorates, and eventually the crusaders wind up capturing the city and keeping it for themselves at that point.
It was a good city. I mean, it was a big one. It may have been the biggest one.
Well, one of the ways you can then think about this, and you see Pope Innocent III, for example, in the aftermath of the Crusade, saying, well, we just captured Constantinople. It is one of it's the heart of the Greek Empire. Clearly, this must be part of, again, God's plan.
Yeah, right.
That the Greeks were, in fact, rejecting Roman authority, that the Greeks had strayed into heresy. I want to remind you here, I'm talking on behalf of Innocent III.
Yes, right. I see.
This was the Latin argument, was that the Greeks had, in fact, deviated from God's law and rejected Rome, and now they were being punished. And
right.
So God had decided to transfer, and this brings up the book of Daniel that you mentioned earlier. There's this famous passage in the book of Daniel where Nebuchadnezzar has a dream of a statue, with, I think it's a head of gold, and a chest of bronze, legs of iron, or feet, and then feet of iron and mud. I think I'm missing one metal in there somewhere. but this dream is interpreted as the idea that empire and imperial power will change hands and transfer. And at first, it was in the hands of the Babylonians, and it goes to the Persians,
right.
And then it goes to the Greeks, and then the Romans. And there's this popular model about the idea that God sort of ordains that imperial power will move around.
Right.
And Innocent actually quotes, Pope Innocent quotes the book of Daniel.
Right.
And he says, hey, here we see it again. Empire, the Byzantine Empire is being transferred over.
Right, old Romes and new Romes.
Yeah,
Romes
and then the Latin,
move around.
They're getting the imperial power back.
Yeah.
And for Innocent, this is the first step, again, towards future events. Now, with Constantinople in our power, we'll be able to recover Jerusalem, defeat the Muslims, spread the Gospels. Of course,
right.
This doesn't quite work out that way.
So, this may be a little bit outside your ken. I'm sure it's not actually. What did the Greeks think about all of this? What did the Byzantines?
I was just going to mention.
Yeah.
Obviously, the Greeks don't feel the same way about the whole outcome of the Fourth Crusade.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't work a lot on the Greek side myself, but it's a natural, I think it's a natural question to ask. And, you know, clearly, you know, the Greeks don't think that they've been punished by God any more than, you know, if you ask the Jewish rabbi in the second century,
right.
you know, that God had punished them for rejecting Christ. I mean, there's a whole separate perspective there from the
yeah.
Eastern Christian community.
Right.
It's
so
important
to
remember that. In fact.
Do you know anything more about the way they interpret this? I mean, I guess it just strikes me that they must have thought that the Western Church, and we want to be careful with that because there really wasn't so much a Western Church, or there was something, but that they'd gone crazy. What could they be thinking?
There's letters from there's Greek emperors basically in exile in the 13th century, and one of the things, Innocent initially, Pope Innocent is quite enthusiastic early on about what's happened here, but then increasingly reports come back to him about the fact that crusaders were plundering and raping and abusing Greek Christians, and you actually see letters from the Greek emperors in exile writing to the Pope and saying,
yeah.
I mean, you're not acting like Christians. I mean,
right.
you are preying upon us. And Innocent increasingly starts to say, like, how are we supposed to bring the Greeks back into the fold when we're treating them? They see us like dogs. They see us like
yeah.
vicious bullies, basically.
Yeah.
And so everyone was aware of the fact that, in theory anyway, there was supposed to be a certain bond of brotherhood between Christians. And I think the Greeks were not slow to point out the fact that the capture of Constantinople
yeah.
could be seen as perhaps, you know, violating that bond.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a rich irony. So let's go back to this point you made, and it's one of the most important points in the book, and that is that, so when things are going well, then they're following God's directions. That's all good. But when things are going poorly, they say it's because God is punishing them for their sins, and those sins have to be cleaned up. And this turns out to be a kind of problematic logic for them. Why don't you explain that?
It does. I mean, one of the things I started to see as I moved into the 13th and 14th century in my research was an increasingly sort of, I guess we might say, radical strand of apocalyptic thinking, which still believed that the destiny of the church was to spread around the world, to bring into the fold Jews, Muslims, infidels. But what they started to imagine was that, in fact, it is not the corrupt church of this present world. It is not the corrupt Roman church of this present world. But there's going to have to be a purgation first,
mm-hmm.
that it will be a new spiritual church.
Mm-hmm.
And part of this taps into, again, mentioning Joachim of Fiore, whom I mentioned earlier, who had this powerful model of history based on the Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
That there was the age of the Father, which is basically back up until from Adam to Christ, the age
mm-hmm.
of the Son, which lasted from Christ up until around the time of Joachim in the 12th century. And then what Joachim foresaw was that there would be this future age of the Holy Spirit. And this would be a transformative moment. This is when the Jews would convert and the Greeks would return to the faith. What you see in the 13th century are some followers of Joachim. And Joachim himself never said this, but some of his devotees, generations later, start to argue that transformative era of the Holy Spirit will in fact mean an effective end to the present-day Roman Church.
Mm-hmm.
It's sacraments, it's different institutions, the power of the clergy would in a sense lapse, and you would see this new spiritual leadership of monks, and you'd see a new spiritual era. Now you can imagine how the Pope might react to this,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And you see some churchmen, and this happens, there's this particular episode in the mid-13th century, where this one Franciscan, who Gerard of Borgo San Donino, he writes a book basically saying, in this new spiritual age, all these things are going to happen. And he is investigated by the Franciscan order. He's investigated by a papal commission. He's eventually thrown in prison,
mm-hmm.
and his book is burned.
Mm-hmm.
But this idea doesn't go away, and I trace it in the book into the 14th century, late 13th, 14th century, where apocalyptic thinkers are highly critical of the Roman papacy and highly critical of the present-day church.
Mm-hmm.
Still envisioning the future world where Christendom will be realized on a global scale.
Mm-hmm.
But first, there's going to need to be this purgation, this cleaning of house, basically.
Yeah, let me ask the obvious question from the point of view of someone who's a sort of lapsed Lutheran. Is there any connection between this and what happens much later during the 16th century?
Well, you know, I end the book on, speaking as a lapsed Catholic, I'll throw that out there. I end the book in the 14th century. And part of why I do that is, you know, I mentioned earlier in the interview that you know, I'm tracking these apocalyptic thoughts during the era of sort of papal ascendancy, when the papacy was a very powerful institution. And just to generalize, when you get into the 14th century and you have the schism, you have the papacy move to Avignon, first of all, the sort of infamous for some people Avignon papacy. And then you later on have a schism where you have a pope in Rome and a pope in Avignon. Eventually there's three popes. To make a long story short, the 14th century is an era where the age of papal monarchy, so to speak, the age where the papacy is at its greatest extent and greatest power, sort of draws to a close.
Mm-hmm.
However, I try to suggest in the epilogue to my book that these ideas about the conversion of the world, they don't go away.
Mm-hmm.
They start to look a little different, certainly. I mean, for one thing, in the later Middle Ages, you start to see increasingly powerful, what we would say, sort of proto-nation states, I guess you could say. I mean, the Kingdom of France, the Kingdom of Spain.
Yep.
And you start to see this idea that it is in fact these kings that will spread Christianity. You know, the king of Spain will spread Christianity.
Uh-huh.
King of Spain. And of course, then where this leads you to eventually is someone like Christopher Columbus.
Yeah.
And you start looking into late 15th and 16th centuries, and you have someone like Columbus. And a lot of people don't know about Columbus's Book of Prophecies. I just discovered this myself not too long ago, where in between his third and fourth voyage to the Americas, to the New World, when he was particularly out of favor at this point with the Spanish crown, he compiled, with the help of a monk, a book of different prophecies from the Bible and from post-biblical apocalyptic thinkers, including Joachim of Fiora, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And the point of these prophecies were to show that Columbus's voyages of discovery were, in fact, fulfilling God's plan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I found as late as I mentioned very briefly Thomas of Malvenda, he's a Jesuit in the 17th century, and he's still exploring this idea that the conversion of the Indians in the New World, that now the gospel has spread around the entire world.
Right.
And so perhaps again, we are approaching this point of the end times. But the story I'm telling, I think it does have this sort of post-medieval implications.
We just need to find that unblemished red calf, and then we're all
set.
I
don't know where that is.
I don't either, but it's probably here in the Midwest somewhere, and I know that there are some very hardworking Orthodox Jewish and fundamentalist Christian cattle breeders who are really
working
hard on
it. I don't think my book will help. I should say, in all honesty, so there's no false advertising, that I don't think there'll be any clues for the red calf.
Yeah, no,
they should still read it. But
no, I agree completely. They probably will enjoy it. I know that I did. So let me ask a couple of questions which are partially related to the main topic of the book, but I think they'd be interesting to the listeners, and I know they'd be interesting to me. One concerns sources, and I don't think people realize I just don't think people realize how difficult it is to do this work. And I'm not throwing you any bones because I've done it myself.
Sure,
it really
sure.
is hard because the source base is peculiar. Can you talk a little bit about the sources?
Yeah, I mean, I have this joke with a friend of mine who's a fellow historian. She does African history. And we joke sometimes that historians aren't particularly smarter than anyone else. They're just more obsessive.
Yeah.
I mean, you're basically willing to devote a large chunk of your time to reading text, oftentimes in foreign languages, and obsessively digging into them. And of course, in my case, this involves reading medieval Latin and digging into some theological texts and apocalyptic texts that can be very foreign to our own sensibilities.
Yeah.
Prophecies can be really bizarre. I mean, we've been talking about this red calf. I mean, when you're reading a 12th century text and it starts talking about, you know, there will be a black eagle that will appear in the sky and it will have swords for its tail, and you're trying to figure out, like, what is going on here exactly?
Yeah, no, I don't know. So, but in addition to being difficult to understand and read, they're also few. I mean, compared to, you know, anything after the 15th or 16th century. I mean,
definitely. I mean, this is a particular challenge for people who work in the Middle Ages. I think, like you said, up until around the... And certainly around the 14th, 15th century, and then in the 16th century.
Yeah,
but you have a limited source base. I mean, one of the positive things about that is the fact that a lot of the sources have been edited.
Yeah.
So they're in Latin, but they're in these editions, which if you have a large research library, you can have access to.
Yeah, no, that's terrific. A lot of them are online these days as well.
Now, there's this collection called the Patrologia Latina, which is quite old. The editions themselves are sometimes faulty and quite old. But it's still a great starting point. It's something like 215 volumes.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's all online at this point. Although it still is useful. You know, I did spend some time doing research at the Bibliothèque Nationale. I went to the British Library. I went to the Vatican. And it's still useful to go back and actually consult original manuscripts.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, it's fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great to be holding like an 11th century.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
But you can still find these little gems here and there in the manuscripts themselves.
Yeah, that's great. So things are still being uncovered in the archives then.
Yeah, I mean, in many cases, texts will be misidentified.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might, a historian will come along and look at it and realize that this isn't what the person doing the catalog 100 years ago thought it was.
Right, exactly.
You can sometimes find texts that people have known about but mm-hmm. haven't necessarily paid attention to. And then, of course, you know, writing history in 2009, we are asking very different questions than historians 30 years ago or historians 60 years ago.
Yeah, which actually
brings me to my next question that I had, which is related, and that is, this brings a certain presentism, which I'll indulge again, to your topic. But
I don't mind indulging in presentism.
All right, I don't really know
it
either.
Clear.
Yeah, I don't either. The a lot of my colleagues do, but the one of the things I found very interesting in the book was the if I understood it correctly, was the attitude that the papacy and the crusaders and those who wrote apocalyptic texts had toward Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me as really profoundly different than the one which we think about when we think about anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
That they're really very different things. Can you talk a little about that? Am I wrong about that? Or?
Well, I mean, it's, again, I think a good word here is this idea of a certain ambivalence. I mean, to have, you look at the Christian Bible. You have the New Testament and you have the Old Testament. You can't have the New Testament without the Old Testament, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's this idea that is sort of deeply ingrained, particularly in medieval theology, that Christianity emerged from Judaism. And there's this sense of Christians have entered this new covenant, this new relationship with God. But there's this hope that eventually, and again, this is based on the letter to the Romans and certain biblical passages, there is this hope that there will eventually be this return of the Jews. They will convert to Christianity. They'll recognize the truth.
Mm-hmm.
There's an important idea here, is this idea, it's sometimes called the Augustinian doctrine of witness, or which is referring to Augustine of Hippo, writing in the late 4th, 5th centuries. And he has this idea, and it's based on the Book of Psalms, that you should basically drive the Jews out. They should be held in contempt, so to speak. But at the same time, do not destroy them. Do not slay them.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, we need them as witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our Messiah emerged from their religious mm-hmm. tradition. You know, it is the Hebrew scriptures that predict the coming of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
We need to have them here as witnesses to the truth of our faith.
Mm-hmm.
And alternately, it says in the Bible that they're going to convert.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we can't kill them all off.
Right.
And again, this is an idea that still plays out in some different ways in certain evangelical circles now.
Yeah.
That there needs to be a Jewish presence in the Holy Land as part of the end time scenario.
Yeah.
And this leads to the uncomfortable idea that when Christ does return, the Jews will face a choice. Do they convert and recognize Christ, or are they damned?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it does make for some strange bedfellows.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think the thing that came to my mind while I was reading is exactly that, the emphasis on conversion,
mm-hmm.
that these were not infidels. These were a different sort of folk, and that they needed to be, or would of their own volition, convert. And this is very different, I think, from the modern, really post-Nazi understanding of anti-Semitism, might be. It's just a very different understanding. And I really think the Orthodox, or what should I say, the fundamentalist Christians in the United States are sort of closer to that spirit of things, that they understand that they don't partake of that sort of post-Nazi anti-Semitism or anything like it. And so I think it's a way to understand exactly the way they feel about the Holy Land and what's going on there. It helps us, it clarifies what we see going on the ground, both here in the Midwest and places, you know, I'm sure in North Carolina as well, but also in the Holy Land, because the taint of virulent sort of Nazi anti-Semitism is still with us, but they are not, I think, guilty of it. So
yeah, I mean, first of all, biological ideas of race were not operative in the Middle Ages.
Yeah,
really.
Right.
I mean, you can't, and this is an idea that you actually start to see even back in the very, very late Middle Ages and early modern period, that it's something in the blood.
Yeah.
And you can't, you can baptize someone, but you cannot change their blood or change who they are.
Well,
this
I know that
it's a very different mentality than this idea of conversion.
Yeah, I know, and I think that it starts. I don't know if it starts, but I've, my cursory reading of it says that that actually the Nazis weren't exactly the first to think of it in this way, but in fact the Spanish were. That,
yeah, exactly. This is an idea that starts to develop in Spain with the this idea of the purity of blood.
Exactly.
But then, of course, in the 19th and early 20th centuries, with the rise of modern medical science, it takes on a whole much more intense form. And obviously, that factors into this incredibly vicious interpretation.
Yeah. No, that's right. Well, I mean, your book's illuminating in many ways. We've taken up a lot of your time, Brett, and we really appreciate it. I should say that the book we've been talking about is Dominion of God, Christendom and Apocalypse in the Middle Ages. And, Brett, let me conclude the interview by asking you our traditional, I guess it's traditional now, final question here on New Books in History, and that is, what are you working on now? What is your next project?
Well, I'm still interested in some of these questions about missionaries and the spreading of Christianity, although now I've looked at all these apocalyptic ideas. I'm kind of interested in what actual missionaries on the ground did.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm basically still chasing after missionaries and also a bunch of papal letters that they would write to Muslim rulers.
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of correspondence and diplomacy that actually went on between Muslims and Christians in the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, that's an interesting topic. Let me pitch an idea to you. I do this sometimes with authors, and it's something that I encountered in my own research. And you know, we have this notion, for example, that the Black Plague, 1350, that somehow it lasted a little while and then stopped. Well, as you well know, it didn't really stop. That these pestilences kept happening into the 16th century or maybe beyond, for all I know. Well, it's similar. It's kind of similar with Crusades. I mean, we think of them as a phenomenon of the medieval period or the Middle Ages, but in fact, they were preached well into the 16th century, and I know that they were preached against Russians, for example, in the 16th century. And I would love to see a book that sort of took the story of the crusading spirit past the invasions of the Holy Land and into sort of the time in which we think that they lapsed. Maybe there is such a book. I don't know.
Well, I mean, there's one historian, Norman Housley, who's worked quite a bit on the later Crusades, but I think you're onto something there that a lot of times we think the Middle Ages end around the year 1500, and I think it's really helpful, actually, to think across that divide.
Yeah, no, I do,
and
too.
And so this work I'm doing on missionaries, for example, I've sometimes considered starting out around the year 1400 and actually bringing the book up to around 1600 or something like that.
Yeah.
It's interesting. These boundaries are artificial, ultimately.
Yeah,
historians make them up. The Middle Ages end, the modern era begins.
Yeah.
I think it's helpful to think outside the box and look across those.
No, I think that's, I think you're absolutely right about that. I know that in the work that I'm doing now, people who do the history of the book and things like this have been pretty successful at that. So I wish you a great luck. And also, I should say, someone who has brought up as a Lutheran, I mean, we think Lutherans think across that divide quite a bit for various reasons, because Luther was really a person in the Middle Ages. I mean, we think about him, he really was somebody with a kind of medieval mentality. Yeah, exactly. So anyway, well, Brett, thank you very much for being on the show. I really enjoyed talking to you today.
Yeah, thank you very much, Marshall.
All right. Okay, take care. You've been listening to an interview with Brett Whalen about his new book, Dominion of God, Christendom and Apocalypse in the Middle Ages. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.